In January of 1980, there was a magazine, or in the magazine The Plain Truth, there was an article entitled, "Prepare Now to Greatly Reduce Your Standard of Living." The article started this way: "It's time you knew the real meaning of the present inflationary spiral, rise in interest rates, and fears of entering a severe depression." Some of you weren't here in January of 1980. I mean, literally weren't here at all. Some of us were. And I remember well the inflationary spiral. We were on a small farm raising apples and pressing cider in the Colville area, north of Kettle Falls. And we were involved in a nasty situation. I got involved in a fight over water. The little place that we'd purchased was advertised to have irrigation water. Well, there was indeed a well, but it was someplace else, and there was no actual water right to the property that we purchased. And so we found ourselves on the short end of a long stick, or the long end of a short stick. And either way, we took a beating. It doesn't make any difference. But as I recall, we were short of funds. We had to borrow money to operate in those days. And when the banker learned that there was no water to the place, well, guess what? There was no loan, no money to come forth to do the operating with. So I had a choice to make. We had to choose between making the payment or operating another year. So I went to the guy that bought the place from and explained the situation to them. He didn't have any sympathy one way or another. Pay up or get out. So we were stuck between the rock and a hard place, as they say. So I talked to my attorney about this. He says, well, you got two choices. You can tell the guy, you can shove it, back down the guy's throat that you bought it from, or you can sue your neighbor that owns the well. I didn't like either choice. Didn't move all the way from Oregon to northeastern Washington, to shove the place down the guy's throat and then be where would I be? I didn't like the notion of suing my neighbor either. It just didn't seem like the Christian thing to do. But we got 3 years. Long and short of it was, the thing went to court. We were 3 years behind in our payments. And the court, of course, too bad, man. We lost the court case. We were 3 years behind in the payments and literally on the short end of the stick. So we went to the bank, sang this swan song to the banker, and the banker sucked it up, believed it, and how I was going to be able to somehow generate enough money to make the regular month mortgage payment and make up the new payment, so on and so forth. Long and short of it was, the interest rate was prime plus 2%. Prime was 19%. So 21% loan. I signed a paper that indicated the interest rate would not go below 12 nor above 21. So we were smack up against 21% interest rate. And actually it went up to 23 before it was over with. But I was, only had to go to 21, so it was no problem. Well, the problem was we lost her altogether. You've heard, is it Willie Nelson's song, "If you haven't gambled for love and lost, you haven't gambled at all." Well, if you haven't lost the farm, actually, you haven't really farmed, I guess. So I remember the situation very well, and I was on that place going through that situation when this article came out. And I thought, we're in good shape. There ain't no way we can worry about raising our standard of living at this point in time. And so, hey, there's one time I'm right in check, man. Lockstep with just what's being printed. There was no way I was going to raise my standard of living right away. So it goes on, the article goes on to say, there is far more to all this economic concern than appears on the surface. Its roots even penetrate back into ancient history and biblical prophecy. Where are the United States and British nations mentioned in Bible prophecy? Most people don't know that they are mentioned in Bible prophecy. What is prophesied about these very conditions? What does it all really mean? What does it portend for the relatively immediate future? So the article goes on to describe, of course, the identity of the United States and British Commonwealth in biblical prophecy. Talks about the descendants of Abraham and where they were going to end up. Discusses the separation between the house of Judah and the house of Israel, how Israel lost its identity on account of having given up the Sabbath and the holy days and so forth. But it talked also in the article about the promises to Abraham, how there were promises of grace on the one hand, that is, through Judah, one of the sons of Jacob, would come the Messiah, through whom all nations would be blessed. And on the other hand, there were promises to Abraham as a result of race, that is, because you obeyed me, Abraham, I will bless your offspring with physical blessings. Now, of course, the article goes on to point out that once the blessings were delivered, then they became contingent upon obedience. All right? And so the article goes on to explain why you should greatly reduce your standard of living, because God is about to lift his hand and his blessing from the descendants of Abraham in the face of the United States and British Commonwealth. So that was about to take place. So that was the lesson. That's what the article pointed out. And so the article ends this way. It says, but already the noose is around our necks and is almost daily tightening. Skyrocketing inflation, devaluation of the dollar in all foreign markets, other economic ills are starting to greatly reduce our standard of living. I warn you, he said, prepare greatly to reduce your standard of living. Even greater punishments are to follow for disobedience. Boy, what happened? That was 1980. That was a long time ago. 29 years almost. So what happened? Well, inflation kind of cooled, you remember? The Iran hostage situation calmed down. You remember, we're running up to the 1980 election. And then Governor Reagan was campaigning, if you'll recall, and asking us all, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And so on and so forth. Well, okay. So the inflation calmed down, and you know, we were just lived through the energy crisis of the 70s. You recall? Any of you were in line waiting for gasoline, trying to get to work, and all that sort of stuff. And the Arabs who controlled the oil, they were upset with the United States and our allies because we had intervened to bail out Israel as a result of the Yom Kippur War. If we hadn't intervened, Nixon had not intervened at that point, the Arabs indeed would have pushed Israel into the sea. There wouldn't be an Israel today. So they were upset, turned off the spigot altogether, and the price of oil went up 70% overnight from $3 a barrel to $5.12. Ooh. So, seemed like a tragedy then, didn't it? But things calmed down. We forgot all about it. And then what happened? In the 1980s, the nation engaged or started out on what turned out to be the biggest binge of consumer spending in the history of mankind. The 80s and into the 90s, and I suppose you could say even today. Now, there are a couple of things that any writer trying to address the situation at the time could not have foreseen taking place at the time. One is the escalating debt that the American public and government was about to enter into. And the second was the state of energy production worldwide. Let's deal with escalating debt first. Now, Mr. Armstrong always used to say, if you want to figure out what's going to happen down the road a ways, don't look at the thermostat. That tells you what's going on in the room. If you want to really know what's going to happen, go down in the boiler room and check out what's going on down there. Now, in the old days, you know, boiler rooms meant you're shoveling coal or doing something. And if the supply was low, well, you know, you had to figure out how to improve the supply. You're going to get coal fairly soon. All right, so what happened? Escalating debt. It's interesting. I have here a chart of this is from the U.S. Treasury Department website. It's a chart, just a graph of the growing national debt of the United States from 1940 to the present. That's very interesting. It's from World War II, of course. From 1940 through 1945, we were fighting World War II, and lo and behold, we did have to finance part of that conflict. And some of you may remember, I certainly do. This would have been after the war. saving our nickels and our dimes and our quarters, and buying stamps that we put in our little book and traded in for a war bond, we called it. $18.75. When it matured, it was worth $25. Went to repay the debt. I mean, that's how we paid it off. Well, the debt at that time was far less than $500 billion. It was flat way up until Vietnam. About 1968, it starts to go up from 68 to 75 or so, because the Vietnam War was financed with what? I don't know, red ink or something. 1980, the run-up to the 1980 election, the John Birchers, they're pretty active up in Stevens County. And so they're campaigning, and this sign started showing up in yards around the county. No, it said, to $1 trillion debt. $1 trillion, not 10. No to a single $1 trillion debt. And so, sure enough, Reagan is elected, and in 1981, just that same year he took office, the government of the United States reached the $1 trillion debt level. All right, so when Reagan left office, the debt was $2.7 trillion. George I came in 1988. When he left, it was $4.1 trillion. Clinton then had his 8-year stint. When he left office, it's $5.8 trillion. George II is there now. When we get a new president installed in office, the public debt and the national debt of the United States will be $10 trillion. Now, what they don't tell you is, in addition to the $10 trillion that we owe, there are also $50 trillion of what is called unfunded liabilities or obligations, things like Medicare, Social Security. We've promised this stuff, but we have no way of paying. We hope that when the day comes that we have to fork it over, there'll be money there. Now, there's wishful thinking for you. Now, I'm talking trillions here, and you don't even know what a billion is, do you? I don't either. But we're talking trillions now. And so there's no way you could have known that, and suddenly there it is. Do you know what? How would you like to pay the debt, the interest on $10 trillion? Oh, well, you are paying the interest on $10 trillion, as am I. So it's a great situation we're faced with. Now, so then comes in the news today. This is today's paper, business section, A6 in the Spokesman Review. Buffett predicts giants will survive. Great. The great Warren Buffett. You know, follow Buffett and you'll get rich. This is about Fannie and Freddie. You know, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Billionaire investor Warren Buffett said Friday he believes now, mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are too big to fail. Oh. It might have been said the same of Rome and Greece and Persia. Yeah, and Babylon and Assyria. They might have, oh, the same thing may have been said of them. Oh, they're too big and too powerful. They can't fall. Freddie and Fannie are looking for help, obviously. And the scale of help is such that I don't think it can come from the private sector. You know what private sector means? It means investors buying stock in a particular organization. Private sector. Private sector doesn't want to touch it. So Fannie and Freddie's shares have lost more than 90% of their value this year. 90%? The two together hold about half of outstanding U.S. mortgage debt. You know what half of outstanding U.S. mortgage debt is? $5.5-6 trillion. Added on to the 10, added on to the 50. Now what happens? It says here the government's going to have to bail them out. What? Who's the government? Defaults in their portfolios are mounting. You know who the government is? You and I are the government. Now, where does the money come from? How do we finance such stuff as that? Well, you know, it used to be you had to have paper and ink to print money. We don't have to print money anymore. We just do a little electronic voodoo, transfer a few, you know, digits out there in cyberspace someplace, and voila, it's done. Trillions of dollars. Change hands. All right, that's something you wouldn't have especially known. But when that kind of thing happens, what's in Rome, they used to clip coins, right? Gold coins in the Roman Empire. And when things got tight, you just shaved the slightest little bit off the outside edge so that you would hope that the guy that was you're trading with didn't notice. But you collect up the shavings and make a new coin. It's called inflation. And so that's what we're doing. We're just unabashedly doing it to the term, to the, you know, thousands, trillions. What's after trillion? Hope I don't have to live to see it. All right, so this is what was happening. Now, when that's, you know, what happens when you don't pay your light bill? Anybody ever experienced not paying your light bill? Well, maybe 30 days they give you this red notice. And after that, what happens? They turn the lights out. Does the lights ever get turned out on nations? What happens when a nation, you know, reneges on its obligations? All right, 1979, one other thing that you couldn't have known. Anybody writing about the situation couldn't have known either. But in 1979, world per capita energy production peaked in 1979. Did you know that? Most people don't. And so let's just take a look at energy for just a bit. Per capita global energy production worldwide peaked in 1979. Well, now, I didn't know that. Who knew that? Well, we couldn't have known that in 1979 because you don't know when energy production peaked until you get a year or two down behind. You look back and you say, uh-oh, we didn't produce as much this year as we did last year. That's not to say that energy production didn't increase, but now population is outrunning energy production. So the amount of energy per capita worldwide has gone down since 1979. Here's a short synopsis. World oil production, world oil data from 1960 to 1999 happened this way. From 1960 to 1973 was a whopping 6.65% increase in oil production every year from 60 to 73. From 1973 to 1979, growth slowed to 1.49% per year. Then from 79 to 99, it slowed yet further to a glacial 0.75% per year. Now, moving beyond the historical period, the forecast was that world oil production will reach its all-time peak in 2006. Then from its peak in 2006 to the year 2040, world oil production will fall 58.8%, an average decline of 2.45% per year during those 34 years. Now, you understand what this means? This is a stunning development. Not since 1979 have we had as much oil or as much energy per person as we did then. Now notice, 1979, we didn't know what was happening in 1979. But world energy production peaked. Now here's the quote of the week. This is from just a couple of weeks ago. David Strahan, the Telegraph in the UK. Here's the quote of the week. It is endlessly reported that the demand for oil in Asian countries has soared since the turn of the century, and that is 2000, and that China's thirst has been especially prodigious. What is less realized is that global oil production has been essentially stagnant at around 86 million barrels a day since early 2005. And yet population continues to go up. And so what happens? We run into a situation where we have, increasing demand, diminished and pinched supply, and we get ourselves into trouble. So what's down the road? All right, I have an interesting little report here. This is entitled World Oil Balance. It's from the Energy Information Administration, Department of Energy, United States government. And what it does is it gives you the total oil production in the world 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, and the first quarter of 2008. Now it's an interesting thing. What we have here is we notice that in 2004, world oil production was about 420,000 barrels per day above demand. Okay, so we were producing more than was actually being purchased or consumed. What was the price of oil in 2004? A whole lot less than $115. 2005, it actually had a little more surplus. There was a 680,000 barrel per day surplus being produced throughout 2005, and yet in May of 2005, we hit the peak all-time production record. Not since May of 2005 have we produced as much. Then what happened? 2006, we actually fell short by 310,000 barrels a day. In 2007, the year ended 1 million barrels a day short of production. Now, what does that mean? Well, how do you consume more than you produce? Oh, well, you've got reserves over here. You open up the valve a little bit bigger, you see, so that you get more oil, satisfy the demand. Well, that's what we're looking at. Now, there's the opinion of some that when the day comes that OPEC produces as much oil as and controls 51% of the oil, then you'll have a division, two camps in the world, one camp with surplus oil, the other camp with none. Well, guess what? You take a look at oil production just now. Now, OPEC hasn't quite reached the 50% mark by themselves. But if you throw in the former Soviet Union and OPEC, between them, they currently control about 49 million barrels per day of production, leaving the rest of us with 36 million. Now, the United States is in hock for oil, right? We produce a whole lot less than we currently consume. Just to give you an idea how much, our current production, first quarter of 2008, we're producing at the rate of about 8.64 million barrels a day. Over 8.5 million barrels a day. I can't comprehend how much oil that is. That's a bunch of oil. We consume 21 million barrels a day. The United States alone consumes 1/4 of all the oil produced in the world. And we have to buy 70% of it. Now stop and think about what that means. Now the price of oil goes from $5 a barrel. In 1999, the general idea was that oil would stay at $5 a barrel forever because there was so much of it. What happened? Well, so you have this big escalation in price, and what takes place? Well, a massive transfer of wealth from the United States to wherever, right? And so we're running up against it. The noose is indeed tightening. Now, the timing was a little out of whack, right? The noose didn't come too tight in 1980. Things eased up. We had a bit of a wake-up call in the 70s. President Carter tried to get us on an energy policy, but we didn't like the fact that we were going to have to tighten our belts and deal with reality, so we voted the bum out and brought in Reagan. And instead of tightening our belts in 1979, 1980, 81, 82, we put it off to 2007, 2008, 2009. Tighten, we will. But we may hang ourselves. Oh, now here's another wonderful piece in today's paper. This illustrates to a T what is happening in the thinking. Americans are tired of anti-drilling bit. And this was this guy by the name of Ben Lieberman. Senior policy analyst at the Thomas A. Rowe Institute for Economic Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Now listen to what he has to say. If only drivers could avoid high gasoline prices as easily as Congress has avoided doing anything about them. It's Congress's fault, folks. Blame your elected officials. It's not because supplies are tight and demand continues to increase. That's standard Econ 101. Demand goes up, supply goes down. What happens? Price goes up. It happens with anything. Widgets, name it. Gas has dipped below $4 a gallon for the first time in months. That, I tell you, is the thermostat. That's not where you look. That's not the fundamentals. The fundamentals are going on in the boiler room in the energy sector globally. So, the pain at the pump will remain a big election issue. But now the members of Congress are home for the August recess and are asking voters to reelect them. They'll have to explain why the single best energy idea, expanding domestic oil production, isn't even on the agenda. Now, are we all in agreement that there's a finite amount of oil in the earth? I mean, you know, there might be a lot of it still, but there's a finite amount, right? And so, and the United States is in a situation where we're only producing about a third of what we need. We've got to buy two-thirds of it from somebody else. So what does that tell you? Our supplies are running low. Our production peaked in 1970. We should have done something about it then. Well, we did. We continued consuming at a prodigious rate, and now we're in deep trouble. So the way to sustainability is to pump out the last drop of non-renewable resource just as quickly as you can get it out. That's what the man said. The solution is to pump more oil, go offshore, punch more holes. This is what I call Jiminy Cricket economics. You remember the story of Pinocchio? If you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are. Wherever you poke a hole in the earth, will come forth great gushes of light, sweet crude. It just can't happen. Let's go on. Other measures. Crackdowns on speculators. Oh, that's the speculators that are doing it. Subsidies for alternative energy sources. Tax hikes on oil companies. That's it. Tax the profits out of the oil companies. Then they won't have any money to rebuild the rusting and aging infrastructure. When the pipeline breaks down, I don't care how much oil is in the ground, you aren't going to get it in your automobile. So on and so forth. A far better option is to open the vast oil-rich areas of the United States. Vast oil-rich areas of the United States, both onshore and in our territorial waters, that inexplicably remain restricted despite skyrocketing prices. Polling shows that the public strongly supports opening the 85% of America's offshore areas currently off-limits. Areas believed to contain 19 billion barrels of oil. Ooh, 19 billion, that's a bunch of oil. But it hasn't actually been pumped out yet. It is believed to be there, 19 billion. The same is true of the promising onshore regions in the Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, a tiny portion of which is estimated to contain 10 billion more barrels. Wow, 29 billion barrels of oil just waiting to be pumped out of the ground. Now, we haven't actually found it yet, and you know that you can't just go down to the local Ace Hardware store and purchase for $19.95 a complete oil drilling kit, bring it home in the trunk of your car. Those 29 billion barrels and past experience suggest we'll find far more, perhaps 48 years' worth of current imports from Saudi Arabia. Oh, terrific. 48 years. See, now you're thinking, wow, 48 years supply, that's great. Do you know how much oil we get from the Saudis? Who's our number one customer, or who do we go to for the most oil of anybody that we're buying from? It's the Canadians, number one. And it's not a large percentage, 17%, 12%, something like that. The Saudis are down there below. Now let's look at the 29 billion barrel mark. We're producing we consume 21 million barrels a day. Now stop for just do the math. There's 365 days in a year. 21 million barrels every year. How much does that amount to? $7.5 billion or barrels of oil every year. 7.5 into 29, slightly less than 4. Not 48 years, not 29 years, 4 years. If the stuff was available tomorrow, and it won't be. You see, he's wrong. Past experience tells us that production peaks and then falls. Past experience tells us that the largest fields have been discovered and are being depleted. Past experience tells us that discoveries peak. No, we're not finding as much. Well, we're still finding some, but not as much. All right, so, and then, because here's the information. This comes from a fellow by the name of Matthew Simons. Simons Corporation International, banker to the oil industry. I mean, he's an investment banker. Key findings of digging into the numbers. Here's the numbers, folks. If you look at 2006 oil production, we find that the production that we recorded in 2006 is anchored by fields discovered in the 1950s through the 1980s. Do you know what that means? That means some of a good percentage of the oil that we're consuming came out of fields that were discovered in the 50s. We've been pumping that stuff solid for 50 years and 40 years and 30 years. What happens when you pump something out for 40, 50 years? Well, it gets smaller, doesn't it? You ever have a hole in your backyard swimming pool? One of those plastic blow-up kind? Only 15% of reported production came from fields discovered in the 1990s. New discoveries, those from 2000 to 2006, have provided only 2% of current production. What does that tell you about discoveries made in 2000, 2001, 2, 3, 4, 5? Well, it makes you wonder, where are these guys coming from? All right, so here we are, Matthew Simmons. So we're talking about going into the basement here, down into the boiler room, and looking at the fundamentals of what's going to happen, of why the noose is indeed getting tighter, you know. And you got less and less money to spend on whatever. So here we're back to Matthew Simmons. Now, he was in Vienna, Austria on May 13 and 14 of this year at a conference to secure benchmarks and supply. All right? These are heavy hitters. They're in Vienna. These are the world playmakers in the industry. His report is entitled "The Unknowns in 2008." Is $120 a barrel oil a blessing or a curse? So here's what he says. And so again, he reports that in early 1999, conventional wisdom assumed that $5 oil was about to arrive. Saudi oil would flood the world with cheap oil. $5 oil would last for decades. Everyone bought into the thesis. $5 oil, folks, 1999. We was wrong big time, he says. Okay, so continue. $120 oil seems high. It has many politicians and consumers angry, right, and confused. Big oil pronounces it, well, you know, prices will come down. Oh, but there's some kind of a conspiracy out there. They're out to get us, gouges, right? You've heard the stories. The mantra is, finally, prices will not last. They'll come down surely. No one seems awake yet. The fundamentalists are still being called pessimists and fearmongers. All right, so he's, now again, this is a man who invests billions of dollars in financing the world's oil enterprise. And so, will oil supply soon respond to high prices? What happens when prices go up? You're in business. The price for your product is in demand and the price goes up. What do you do? Oh man, you find a way to produce more, don't you? So you can sell more, make more money? Isn't that the way business works? Well, the simple answer is oil supply has already responded to high prices. And this is the things that we aren't told in the little newspaper articles. Every quality drilling rig in the world is at work. Every single one, onshore, offshore, exploration and production spending has never been higher. Now, this guy's not going to show up in Vienna with the heavy hitters of the energy industry and tell them a bunch of lies. He's not going to be in the investment banking business based on bogus information. He's investing and managing tens of billions of dollars to try to bring oil to market. The response was sluggish in spite of high prices. The reason we've been able to keep pace at all is because of the surge in the former Soviet Union. That's the primary one. And the OPEC players have opened their valves just as far as they could possibly open them. And we're pretty much at max now. And we've removed our buffer. We've removed our safety zone. And so, how fast will we add rigs? Now, it deals with the issue of infrastructure. Because There's no way, he says, we can replace all the old drilling rigs fast enough to keep up with current production. Can't do it fast enough. The yards are fully booked for deep water building. Drilling components are heavily backlogged. Land rig fleet is extremely old. Major replacement needs to be done as soon as possible. Every player now suffers from a lack of parts and shortage of skilled hands to build rigs. Now, you don't hear that part of the story. This is what's going on in the boiler room, folks. These are the fundamentals. This is what's going to be the choke point that's going to cause serious issues. So he talks about the infrastructure rusting away. Almost every component of oil and gas, of the oil and gas system, is beyond the original design life and rusting away. Did you know that? You know what happens when your sewer pipe, the one that takes the stuff from your house to the hookup out there in the street, when it plugs up or caves in or the roots fill up, you know what happens? Things don't work. When any part of the system fails to work, we have trouble. If the system is not rebuilt, supply will artificially suffer acute drop in the next decade, whether we have oil out there or not. Now listen to this. Here again, this is a major investment banker to the world energy sector, and he says rebuilding the industry infrastructure will cost $50 to $100 trillion. Now that kind of takes the bloom off the profit, don't you know? Don't you understand? If oil companies are going to do that sort of thing, they have to have profits so they can invest it and make it happen. All right. So we have troubles. Now, what happens if serious interruptions do take place? What happens is one energy shortage soon trips another, right? We have a lot of coal-fired plants in this country, a lot of oil-fired plants generating electricity. The energy system could shut down in too many places. Without energy, everything, including food, runs dry. We've got to have energy. We've got to have lots of it. The world has no early warning system for the chaos that could occur. There are no fuel gauges, no fuse boxes, no in-place rationing systems, no firewalls, no contingency plans. In 1980 and 1979, we were asleep at the wheel and have stayed asleep to this day. And so, we run into serious, serious issues. Now, one thing about energy we don't all understand is electrical power is really what drives civilization. And so electricity is not a primary energy source, but rather an energy carrier. It's a wonderful source of energy. Zero mass, travels near the speed of light, and for all practical purposes it can't be stored. Moreover, electric power systems are costly, complex, voracious of fuel, polluting, and require 24-hour, 7-day-a-week, 52-week-a-year maintenance, constant. You can't turn your back for a minute. Go down and talk to the Avista folks. See what it takes to keep the electricity coming to our homes. Another problem is that electricity is taken for granted. Just flip the switch and things happen. In short, electricity is the quintessence of the modern way of life. But the electric power systems themselves are demanding, dangerous, and delicate. All this suggests that permanent blackouts will be strongly correlated with the collapse of industrial civilization. And that could happen. When will it happen? Well, of course, that's the question. Now, once again, we're looking at the fundamentals, just in time for this sermon. Got in the mail today, the National Geographic cover article, Where Food Begins. It's about soil. Genesis deals with soil. Dust thou art, to dust thou shalt return, you know, that principle. And so it's talking about food and food supplies. And it's most interesting because the article starts in Wisconsin. So let's go to Wisconsin and notice how they start. On a warm September day, farmers from all over the state gather around the enormous machines, combines, balers, rippers, cultivators, discers, tractors of every variety. All can be found at the annual Wisconsin Farm Technology Day show. All right, here we are, the big displays. $400,000 harvesters. Now, it's most ironic. The front is, there's a picture just opposite the beginning of the article. And on the one hand, you're talking about the Wisconsin Farm Technology Days and $400,000 harvesters and, you know, satellite technology to navigate these machines so that they go in the same place every time so they don't compact too much soil. And on the other side, here's this full-page picture of a bunch of Chinese laborers harvesting rice with a hand sickle. Now, which do you think is sustainable? Which one is being run by solar energy? There's only one form of energy that feeds us, folks, and that's solar energy. Petroleum doesn't do it. Petroleum feeds $400,000 harvesters. Now, when the petroleum stops flowing, we have no contingency plans. We haven't run, you know, the fire drill to see if the contingency plans even work. When that quits happening, the Chinese laborers will still be whacking their, putting their seedlings in the ground by hand and whacking a harvest with a hand sickle. See, we are in a very, very precarious situation. What we do, what our government does, will depend, what they do will, why do you think we're in Iraq, for example, if it isn't to support our energy addiction? Now, just a couple of highlights from this National Geographic article on soil. Even as mankind is ratcheting up its demands on soil, we're destroying it faster than ever before. How's that? Destroying it faster than ever before? We have degraded an area of land the size of the United States and Canada combined. How can we do that? The population of the Earth is 6.7 billion. And every year, we add another 80 billion. In 4 years, we add the population of the United States. Every 4 years. In four more years, there's going to be another United States out there someplace. And what are they going to eat? Well, all right, and once again, we go back to the fundamentals. By 2030, 8.3 billion people will walk the earth, and farmers will have to grow 30% more grain. 30% more grain. And we're eroding soil at a prodigious rate. Just a couple of figures to help you understand why. You remember the Green Revolution? Oh, we had hybrid seeds, and we had irrigation projects, and we had internal combustion engines, and we had fertilizer and pesticides, and man, we ratcheted up the per acre yields immensely. Well, that was great. Per capita grain production increased right along until 1985. In 1985, per capita grain production peaked, and it's been going down ever since. Population is outrunning production. All right, so what does all this mean? Let's go back to the article just briefly. Don't rest on, now is not the time to go to sleep, folks, and think, oh, everything's fine, it's going to go on just like it's always gone on, and they're going to find more oil and everything will be fine. What does it all really mean? When did God lift his hand and remove the blessing from the descendants of Abraham? Was it in 1979 when peak world production of per capita energy peaked? Was it in 1980 when, in 81, when the debt of the United States began to escalate and run crazy? Now, you can just look at what I've described for you today, and I haven't taken time, and I don't have time today, to discuss the impacts of exponential population growth and what that does to energy consumption. We haven't talked about water. All of this might be trumped by a shortage of water. Might bring about the next great tragedy, the next great challenge to us. So, what's to become of us? Let's turn to Matthew 24. Now is not the time to go to sleep. Now is not the time to say, oh, it's okay, it's going to go on forever and ever and ever. Well, the fundamentals are there. Now, you see, and indeed, I can't see any evidence that God has actually intervened to cause any problems. It's just a natural course of events, using up all of our resources and competing for what's left. What happens if God decides, it's the end, it's coming, we're going to start, causing problems here, really stirring things up and escalating the time frame. In Matthew 24, Jesus said, you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. Verse 6, so where are we now? Resource wars are going to be the problem. That's what's going on right now. That's why we're in Iraq. Iraq has the second largest reserve of unpumped oil in the world. Why do you think the United States is in Iraq? To make sure that we got a supply that we can purchase and keep our automobiles running, keep our homes heated, keep our farms running. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet, for nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines. See, God created the earth in such a way that He gave us green plants to collect solar energy that could be converted into food. The agricultural system in the United States and in the industrialized world does not run on solar energy. Now, plants still collect solar energy, but without huge infusions of petroleum in the form of diesel fuel, petrochemicals, pesticides, artificial fertilizers. We don't have an agricultural system. If the petroleum stops running, it's the end of food. Not just the end of, you know, our joy rides on Sunday afternoon. And so this is where we are. Famines? What will cause a famine? Well, that could cause a pestilence, and so it could be pestilence, human pestilence, earthquakes in various places. Wouldn't take much of an earthquake to disrupt major oil production, processing, transporting. You saw what Katrina did in the Gulf of Mexico. They had to shut down offshore oil rigs. They had to shut down onshore refineries for a time. Well, what if they'd been destroyed? In California, you remember the crisis over natural gas and the Enron scandal and all? There was a 5% shortage in supply. You know what it did? It increased the price fourfold, 5%. A little bit in the energy industry is a great bunch. All right, all these are the beginning of sorrows. And so he goes on to say, verse 11 or 12, because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. You ever seen people, attitudes, and such change when they're in line for a precious, short supply resource? Do you know what happens to people when they get in line waiting for gasoline, and they run out of gas while they're waiting for gasoline to get to their turn? What happens to people? You ever seen people go wacko crazy? That's right. The love of many will wax cold when resources are short. He who endures to the end, the same shall be saved. This gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all nations, and then the end will come. Yes, the bottom line is, folks, we're going to have to be bailed out. Mankind is going to have to be rescued. And that's the good news. We will be rescued. But what's the wake-up call? Here we are, summertime, the living's easy. You know, oh yeah, gas is a little expensive, but I see you all made it here today. Well, you probably have plans to do other things. So do I. I mean, come on, you're going to tell grandmothers that pine away for their grandkids that they can't travel to see their grandkids? You know, they might be hundreds or thousands of miles away. I tell you, when there's no oil at all, grandmothers will stop going to visit their grandchildren and so forth. I mean, some things are more important. And I don't speak tongue-in-cheek here. Verse 21, for then will be great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. For unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Now, the point here is not to induce panic on you. I don't know what to do about it. I really don't. I've done everything I know to do. We sold the farm and moved to town so we get out of debt, right? Clean up the credit card debt. Okay, that's good. What else do we do? Turns out that the people that bought the place actually drive to town more than we did. So in actual fact, we took a step back as far as the grandiose scheme of things. So what am I going to do? I'll plant a big garden. That's cool. If I had to eat out of my garden, my pants wouldn't stay tight very much longer. And I got a pretty good-sized garden compared to most. Now, for those of you who are young people and you're building your lives, you've got families, you're looking forward to developing careers and so forth, this is not a call to cop out and quit. No, you do what the rest of us have done, but do it prudently. Consider the warnings. Consider the circumstances that exist. Don't make the same mistakes that have put us into the predicament that we're in, not only nationally, but globally. And so he says, for then will be great tribulation. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. So the promise is we will be bailed out. Now, so the warning is, verse 36, and I think we need to bear in mind, all of that day and hour, nobody knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. Now notice, as the days of Noah were, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man. Now, you know what happened? It happened suddenly. One day it was dry, probably at a record drought in Noah's part of the world. And he gathers up the animals and puts his family in the ark, and they sat there and cooled their heels for 7 days, if you read the account. And you've got to know the headlines in the evening news that night when they're talking about this freak Noah. He'd been in there a week now, folks. How long do you suppose he's going to be there? When the rains came, it was all over. Now, when the tap gets turned off, not all the way, just part of the way, and starts being ratcheted down, interruptions here, there, and the other place, it's going to be sudden. For as the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage, till the day that Noah entered the ark, and they did not know until the flood came and took them all away. So also will be the coming of the Son of Man. What's the lesson? The lesson is, as the sermonette pointed out, you need to be spending a good deal of our time, we do, thinking the way God thinks, developing our spiritual resolve, being faithful and wise servants, as it says in verse 45. Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season? Well, blessed is the servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. And so, we want to be careful. We're warned clearly not to get into the attitude of thinking, well, my master delays his coming, no big deal. It's not important to keep the feast this year. And the next thing, you don't do it the year after that either. You don't do it for 5 years. You don't do it for 10 years. You know, you've got people, I've got friends and neighbors and relatives. What's that? They don't even remember what it is. Oh, is it that time of year again? Well, let us, with our eyes wide open, live life prudently, my friends, because the end is short and the noose indeed is getting tighter. And when it comes, it's going to come suddenly. And we need to be prepared, alert, awake, on our knees, seeking the will of God daily.